I am always interested in portraying characters that are somehow based on what I see as a reality. And I guess the dramatic potential in this story is this looming subcurrent of emotions that you know, it's not a family that screams and yells and where all the conflicts are apparent from the beginning. We rather go on a journey where we portray them individually with their dreams and flashbacks, memories, and we try formally to create the emotion.
Director and co-writer Joachim Trier there on the dark pool of emotion that ripples beneath his latest drama, Louder Than Bombs. He'll join me in the studio shortly. Also ahead, Kevin Spacey takes over the White House, but not as Frank Underwood. And this time, he has Elvis at his side.
When I read the script, I thought, wow, this is one of the weirdest and most interesting scripts I've read in a long time. And I guess I also, just in a simple thematic way, was very struck by the way that Nixon didn't understand why he should meet Elvis.
We'll hear that report and more from our New York bureau chief, getting in the thick of it at the Tribeca Film Festival. Plus, El Futuro director Luis Lopez Carrasco on how his snapshot of Spain in 1982 is really all about looking ahead. And visionary Portuguese filmmaker Miguel Gomez shed some light on his rather perplexing new epic, Arabian Nights.
We have this very strange working scheme with a crew of journalists researching for us and providing us with material for us to create stories from the reality, but stories that could fit for Shahrazad.
That's all to come on The Cinema Show, your culture guide to the world of movies on Monocle 24. Hello from Midori House in London, I'm Ben Rylan. We'll head to Tribeca in a moment. First though, screens everywhere light up with all manner of superheroes and franchise films continue their takeover. It sometimes feels like we're forced to wait just a little too long in between the smaller, more dramatic fare. Well, thankfully, Norwegian director Joachim Trier has brought what could be described as a particularly European form of restraint to his first movie made in the US. Louder Than Bombs opens with the birth of a child. Jonah, played by Jesse Eisenberg, is a father for the first time, but his private moments reveal a degree of angst over his daunting new responsibility. His mother, Isabel, played by Isabel Huppert, was a renowned war photographer who spent much of her career in some of the world's most dangerous places. Her husband Jean, Gabriel Byrne, and younger teenage son Conrad, Devon Druitt, occupy the other side of her life, one of family responsibilities and other less exciting realities. In some ways, she's a frustrated artist inhabiting the terrain of an idealistic journalist who can't rest until she's changed the world. But it's her untimely death that ultimately forces her family to confront the place she held in their lives.
He's not doing that well. I don't think you should tell him what you told me last night.
I don't know. Don't you think he deserves to know the truth?
The truth? What is the truth? What's some story that Richard wants to write? How is that the truth? He's going to make her out to seem like she's some kind of depressed person.
No, I don't think he will. But she was depressed. You know that, right?
Director Joachim Trier, who also co-wrote the film, popped into Midori House during the week. I asked him how, amongst all the tiny threads at play, he crafted the film's dramatic core.
It's sort of a universal story of family, this. And even though I'm Norwegian-Danish, I studied in England at National Film and TV School, where I went for several years. So I always wanted to kind of venture on and do English language movies. So the question then was, what could I do that would work in America? As I wanted to shoot something in New York, I've been there quite a lot and was intrigued by the place. And these ideas started to come up, and I sit with my co-writer Eskil Fucht, and there's never like a story or just one image. It's usually characters or formal ideas. And we wanted to do something that's a very intimate portrait of a family, where you look at the discrepancy between individuals and the relationship between parents and children. And it's rather sort of we wanted to do something about three generations of men in a family and how they try to connect with women in their lives when the mother has passed away.
I sort of, I don't want to say that it is a battle between a woman's work and her duty as a mother, but I did pick up on some themes of that rippling through the film, but it treats it in a very subtle way, and certainly I would have to stipulate a non-judgmental way too. What were your thoughts on that as you were crafting the story?
I guess a theme that, as a filmmaker, personally, I'm rather intrigued with, and also in general I see in society, is the dichotomy between work, ambition on one hand, and family life on the other. And it's not just for women, it's for men too. And I wanted to do sort of a modern family portrait where the father takes a more motherly role. Gabriel Byrne plays quite a caring father, yet he comes into this dramatic situation of having to talk to his sons about elements of the mother's life that she never revealed to them. And rather than to do the authoritarian father that we've seen so much, that sort of sons have to commit a sort of patricide to free themselves from, I was interested in the kind of a changing dynamic of modern family life.
And the men in the film certainly do have trouble talking to each other, which is something that we do pick up in stories like this most often. But perhaps less often do we see the breakthrough being something that's not a huge dramatic shift of events, but it's really just maybe an emotional progression. Do you think maybe that's more true to life?
I am always interested in portraying characters that are somehow based on what I see as a reality. And I guess the dramatic potential in this story is this looming subcurrents of emotions that you know, it's not a family that screams and yells and where all the conflicts are apparent from the beginning. We rather go on a journey where we portray them individually with their dreams and sort of flashbacks, memories, and we try formally to create the emotion through how the different stories intersect with each other. And for as an example, we see a father trying to connect with his 15-year-old son, and we see several scenes seen from different perspectives, and we loop back and you know, we play around with form. And I think that can create emotion in movies as well. I grew up with a lot of musical inspirations when I was young. I grew up with hip-hop and punk music and, you know, the kind of music where the sound or the form of it, how it was done, was the emotion. And I think in movies we can play around with that too.
Obviously, there's an element of suicide in the film as well. You seem to be quite specific about not determining why that suicide has actually happened. There are some theories that could be put forth, but the film doesn't instruct us. It doesn't tell us why this person did this.
No, but I was curious as to the... We should be allowed to interpret and imagine and dream and change as human beings. The Danger of Sounding is slightly hippie-ish and trite here. But, you know, I'm trying to talk about very, very how vulnerable a family is when they lose someone that they at the same time have idealized. The mother was sort of the pivot, and she becomes a pivotal ghost in her absence. And the whole idea that they're struggling to try to figure out what do they need to still worship about who she was and what terrible sides of her personality do they need to come to terms with. It's rather dramatic, you know. and also, shouldn't we be allowed in one family to not have the same narrative of who we are? Shouldn't we also be allowed for that space of individuality? Which I think, to be honest with you, one of the motivations for doing this film was that I saw around me in life that an ongoing thing in most people I know's lives are grappling with, still at an age of being an adult, grappling with your relationship to your parents and then having children and grappling with the liberation of those children. This ongoing drama that all families seem to have to go through, and try to give that a specific story and hopefully some specific character portraits.
Joachim Trier, the director and co-writer of Louder Than Bombs, out in theatres today. It's carefully crafted and quite affecting in its portrayal of family, loss, and subtle resentments. We've seen Kevin Spacey playing a president before, in House of Cards, of course, but this one's a little different. So is the film, come to think of it. Elvis and Nixon tells the story of the real-life encounter between Nixon, played by Spacey, and Elvis Presley, the rather surprising choice of Michael Shannon, at the White House in 1970. The film, which has plenty of comic moments, debuted at this year's Tribeca Film Festival. Monocle's New York bureau chief Ed Stocker sat down with the director, Liza Johnson, during the big event.
Tell me, Liza, when you got this script on your desk, as it were, what were your initial thoughts when you read it over?
You know, I was actually really surprised by it. I think in some ways it is a kind of bromance genre project, but overall I found it to be so unusual and so defiant of expectations of like, what is a comedy or what is a drama or what is a romance? Or, you know, I found that the juxtaposition of those figures is so absurd as to create a very humorous comedy of situation, but also that the arc written for Elvis and the kind of intimate versions of Elvis that are also included in the story are both unusual to be set against the comedy, and they're unusual as a treatment of Elvis. When I read the script, I thought, wow, this is one of the weirdest and most interesting scripts I've read in a long time. And I guess I also, just in a simple thematic way, was very struck by the way that Nixon didn't understand why he should meet Elvis, and the kind of historical gap between then and now, and the ways that entertainment, culture, and politics are so imbricated in the present, but weren't then, or at least not in the same way. I guess I thought that the structure of the script was special and unusual, and then I also thought that this particular gap was very touching almost, or charming, about Nixon, and it's rare when I think of Nixon that I am charmed.
Did you ever think, gosh, you know, these are big historical characters, these are emblematic figures, we're talking about Nixon and Elvis, these are awfully big shoes to fill. Did you ever think, I just need to run away from this, this is too big in a way?
Well, it's funny because in the other films that I've made, the types of characters that are represented are much more underrepresented. You know, like when I made Return, it seemed at the time possible that it could be the only movie that would ever be made about a female soldier coming home from the contemporary U.S. wars. Happily, that's not the case. But that was my burden on that movie, is like, what if this is the only one? So it's certainly a different burden to try to deal with the kind of incredible scale and just this sheer volume of material that exists on these characters. But in another way, it's very freeing because I know that the audience has the opportunity to compare my version with all these other accounts that exist. And so even though there's some responsibilities that are greater, there is a burden of representation that's not on me in the same way. So it's also freeing.
I mean, the movie mentions the fact that Nixon didn't start recording himself until 1971, and this takes place the year before. How much of the film did you have to kind of be inventive with? I know Jerry Schilling was consulting. How much is added drama and how much is based on first-hand account of what actually happened?
I don't think there was any effort to, you know, sort of add drama exactly, but I think that what we wanted to do, and I worked closely with Jerry and I was so grateful for his participation, and what we agreed was that we would try to stay honest to a certain style of emotional truth. As with any historical material, you know, there's data points and then there's gaps. And I think that one of the things that fiction can do is find ways to live in those gaps. Like if we were making a TV-style documentary, you know, we could look at that letter and we could look at the Haldeman memo and, you know, there's probably like a sign-in book at the White House that maybe Elvis signed and, you know, there's documents that exist. But there is no document of, you know, well, how did Nixon feel about this? Or what was Elvis's emotion? Or how did Jerry and Elvis's friendship grow and change over time? You know, and these concerns are also interesting and they are real, right? There's no record of them, but that doesn't mean that they're not real. And so to me, it's a kind of a fluid question, right? Of like, how much is true? Because like, it's very moving to me the way that Jerry maintained his friendship with Elvis over Elvis's entire life, in part by taking distance at operative moments. That's deep, that's real, and I think it's very meaningful even to what we all know about Elvis. So we could say, oh, you know, some aspects of that friendship didn't happen on that Monday, right? So like, let's say they happened on Thursday and we cut them out of the film, then is the film more true or is it less true? Do you know, because we know that really happened. And so what we tried to do was just like, always come back to those emotional truths. And, you know, did Elvis really eat those M&Ms? I don't know. Is it possible, though, that those men could have felt a feeling of competition towards each other? Hell yes. And there would be no record of that feeling if they did feel it.
Monocle's Ed Stocker with Elvis and Nixon director Liza Johnson at this year's Tribeca Film Festival. We'll head back to the festival a little later in the show. You're listening to The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. We will head to Portugal with director Miguel Gomez soon. Right now, however, we're climbing inside the Midori House time machine and punching in the coordinates for Spain circa 1982. The Spanish indie film El Futuro was shot over just 3 days back in 2013. It's a raucous snapshot of Spain's second democratic elections in 1982. The setting, and why not, is a wild house party where revelers swash drinks and dance around their country's political situation. A debate which back in the 1980s was as precarious as it was hopeful. Fast forward a few decades and Spain is gripped by an eerily similar political climate, where hope and disenchantment are back on the national dance floor. Monocle's Madrid correspondent Liam Aldous sat down with director Luis López Carrasco to talk about how a film set in the early 80s has been strengthened by Spain's current political impasse, and why it resonates with young audiences around the globe.
There was a main objective that was capturing a certain atmosphere. An atmosphere that is joyful, but it's kind of full of disappointment at the same time. We prepare an actual party. I spent 3 days with my friends and some actors, drinking and listening to music for 3 days. So at the same time, it's a historical film, but also it's a documentary of a party that gets wild and wild and wild.
So this historical moment that you talk about is the Spanish transition. The party itself is set in 1982, the time of Spain's second democratic elections, after Franco, of course. The strange thing is that now the Spanish youth are probably arguing and in the midst of a very similar situation, talking about their future and really reflecting on the kind of country they want. Is that something that is an accident about your film? The kind of coincidence that now the film is even more relevant than it was when you were writing it?
Well, I started preparing this film in 2010, and we were just feeling the global economical crisis that, for me, in Spain, is more than just economical. It's institutional, it's social. For me, it was interesting just to look back and seeing the moment where everybody started.
I also heard that obviously you scripted this film, but you shot two versions. You shot the scripted version, and then you did a more of an improvised take. And the improvised take, a lot of the times, was a lot more dramatic and real, and often used in the final cut.
Yeah, for me, the most important thing was to have the sensation of watching a kind of found footage or archive, like home cinema or home tapes that somebody found in the drawer. So for me, it was important that the film, the actors, the atmosphere, all of them, they have to be very fresh, very natural. In every shooting, you have to take control of all the elements. And we realized that if we get rid of control and we let chaos to be part of the shooting, that was more interesting.
Monocle's Liam Aldous chatting to Spanish film director Luis López Carrasco about his 2013 film El Futuro, which movie subscribers can catch now alongside the 2014 dystopian framing of Benidorm in the year 2052, Android's Dream. That's part of a global exclusive playing right now on Mubi, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. And don't forget about that special treat happening at the moment strictly for listeners of The Cinema Show. A whole month of movies for free. Head over to mubi.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. Up next, we'll take a flying carpet ride to Portugal with director Miguel Gomez.
Monocle's travel guidebooks are just the ticket for anyone who wants to get the best out of a city in just a few days, who wants to go local and off the usual tourist track, who needs good coffee and cozy bars, who likes a retail dash as well as a culture bash. Join us on our global tour. There are now 12 books in the collection, including the latest editions, Singapore, Vienna and Paris. And there are many more books coming your way in the next few months. Track our progress and buy your copies today at monocle.com or at any Wise bookstore. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Now, you'll recall last week's interview with the legendary director Peter Greenaway about his excitable new film Eisenstein in Guanajuato. Subscribers in the US can still catch two of his past works, Prospero's Books from 1991 and The Pillow Book from 1996, starring Ewan McGregor. But be quick, they'll be vanishing very soon. Now you best brace yourself, because we're jumping on board a flying carpet now for a ride to Portugal with the director, Miguel Gomes. The current issue of Little White Lies magazine is decorated throughout with illustrations inspired by Miguel Gomez's latest work. And if you dare venture in far enough, hidden deep among the gold and jewels adorning the fine pages, you'll find a letter written by the director to himself. Why, I hear you ask? Well, Little White Lies editor David Jenkins explains.
Arabian Nights originally premiered in Cannes in 2015. So that would have been May, so nearly a year ago now. And in that period, Gael Gomez has probably done more interviews than we'll ever do in our lifetime, you know, but with people who probably look exactly like me. And so I think that for this issue, I think we wanted to I think we're always trying to do something that's a little different from our, we speak to this director, or we hear what this director's got to say. And I think that one of the things that I'd notice about Gomez, whose films I've, his last sort of two films I've loved, is that he's a great director, but he's also an amazing writer as well. He writes in this kind of quite florid, slightly antiquated style. And from rewatching some of his older films and reading the subtitled narrations, it just instantly thought that it'd be great to have him actually write something for us. And then it's trying to work out exactly what that would be, and it ended up being the idea of him writing a letter to himself 10 years ago when he was just about to start out making his debut film called The Face You Deserve.
David Jenkins there. But what did Miguel Gomez think of the idea? I asked him when he popped in for a visit to Midori House.
To be honest, I didn't thought about that when they asked me. I thought they were strange people asking me to do a strange thing. And I've done it because maybe I'm not too defensive and too smart. And so I said, okay, I'll do that, even if I think it's very silly. Yes, but it was the idea of putting things in perspective and from this present moment, try to look back and see what were the difference, what are the difference with me now and the way I feel cinema and my relation with, even with my country.
The Portuguese people are good, but they have debts to pay. We are here to give a helping hand.
Do you think we'll get fired?
Most probably, but who cares anyway?
Yes, they don't know shit. They don't know the Portuguese people. In fact, they don't know what love is.
As he was dreaming up new ways to tell stories of his homeland, Gomez settled upon a particularly epic idea. Why not use Arabian Nights as a canvas? And indeed, well, why not? The epic collection of stories assembled over centuries, but transferring the idea from his imagination to film required a somewhat innovative approach.
Every story was made in a completely different way from the one that we made before. In the film, there are several stories, and for each one of them, we tried to invent a way to film this story. And so, let's say there are stories with actors playing, there are stories with people playing themselves, because all stories, they are based in things, true stories that happen in Portugal during this time. So we had this very, very strange working scheme with a crew of journalists researching for us and providing us with material for us to create stories. To create stories from the reality, but stories that could fit for Shahrazad, could be serve this logical of Shahrazad. That means we don't have flying carpets, for instance, but we have genies and we have very strange creatures and things happening. And so we had the ambition to do this, and for me, storytelling, it's something important. I mean, I wanted to show real things because I wanted to talk about reality, about our time in Portugal, but at the same time, I don't want to renounce to this ability that cinema has of creating fiction and creating wild fiction.
Director Miguel Gomez there on his epic new film Arabian Nights, Volume 1, which is not an adaptation of the well-known book, despite drawing on its structure. It's out in theatres today. And Mubi subscribers can catch Gomez's 2004 film, The Face You Deserve, or, to use its native Portuguese title, A Cara Que Mereces. As we heard earlier, the drama Louder Than Bombs revolves around the death of a mother who dedicated her life to photographing scenes of war and destruction. Ian Olds occupies somewhat similar territory. He's made quite a name for himself in the world of war documentaries, first with Occupation Dreamland from Iraq, and then the harrowing film Fixer, The Taking of Ajmal Naqshbandi, filmed in Afghanistan, which follows an Afghani who worked with an Italian journalist and is subsequently murdered by the Taliban. Olds' latest film, called The Fixer, a narrative feature, draws heavily on his real-life experience but cleverly flips the story to avoid clichés and bring a fresh perspective on what being an Afghani and a fixer really means. Ed Stocker caught up with the New York-based director at the Tribeca Film Festival.
The invasion of Iraq, quite frankly, the idea of preemptive war seemed insane. I mean, I don't know if everybody can think back to that moment, but there was this idea that we're going to war not because they had anything to do with September 11th, but because it was a preemptive war to stop future wars or to find weapons of mass destruction. It was, in my mind, insane. And so I went with a documentary partner and with this idea of doing a Wiseman-esque documentary about the institution of the military, and did not know I was going to be getting into these more conflict situations, didn't expect to be in Fallujah, and found myself very unprepared to be there, but also became strangely accustomed to it, which was somewhat frightening. And before that, before we were involved with the military, I spent 2 weeks in Baghdad, and this was before the kidnappings. And so you could travel freely around the country, and I spent 2 or 3 weeks with Iraqi fixers and American journalists and Western journalists and saw that relationship firsthand. And when we came back, we made a film that I thought was a meaningful piece of work. I ended up losing my documentary partner shortly after that and went to Afghanistan to see what kind of film I would do on my own. And again, but because of that experience in Iraq, I decided that the best thing I could do would be to focus on the relationship between an American journalist, his Afghan fixer, and the story they were telling. And I figured if you did that, that'd be a way to triangulate this relationship to sort of see what was the nature of this war. We went back to the United States to continue raising money to go back for another production trip. And we found out that our translator, Ajmal Naqshbandi, had been kidnapped and murdered by the Taliban. I had planned to completely abandon the project at that point. It was just too painful. But when we went and saw the footage, I went back and looked through all the material we'd shot and realized it was a kind of obligation to go back and tell this story. So we went back, made that film. It was an incredibly painful film to make. After I finished that film, I was proud of the film. I'm glad we told the story, but I knew that I didn't want to go back to war zones. Some people, it's an addiction. For me, it was, I'd lost the stomach for it. After that film, I was involved in the asylum process for another Afghan fixer, and he made his way safely to Europe, jumped through all the bureaucratic hoops, was welcomed to this country, and then found himself thinking, what do I do now? He'd spent so much time thinking about getting there and trying to escape the dangers of the war that he hadn't quite known what to do with himself once he got there. And so he found himself facing this quieter existential crisis. And that's something I couldn't shake. I knew I didn't want to go back to war zones. I also knew I was done with documentary, but his story resonated with me.
And I guess also there are quite a lot of stereotypes about what Afghanistan might be like and what the people there are meant to be like. Did you like the idea of kind of flipping that notion as well?
The other part of the thing that was key for us in terms of how we thought about the film was that we're so used to seeing these films of and stories of Afghans through the lens of war trauma. It's about being a victim or being a terrorist, these kind of simplistic cliches. And we, of course, it's quite obvious, but strangely not represented in film, is that, of course, an Afghan character is going to have a complex inner life that's struggling with the existential issues that we all do. And so, you know, I spoke to Afghan friends, and one of the things they kept saying to me was, I hate being pitied. You know, where is the sense of humor? Where is the sexuality? Where is the conflicted inner life? And so we knew we wanted to create a character that moved beyond those cliches and treated him as a full human being. And at the same time, we knew we wanted the story not to be centered around a trauma in Afghanistan, but to be set almost completely in Northern California. So we could create a dramatically compelling story and then fit this complex Afghan character in the midst of it. So it becomes a character who happens to be Afghan as opposed to a traditional victim of war.
Monocle's Ed Stocker with director Ian Olds. Well, that's it for this week. There will, of course, always be room for mesmerizing special effects in the cinema. But it takes a very skilled hand to evoke an emotional response from the subtlest of devices. Whether it's a long stare or a cleverly crafted assumption planted in the story that surprises us. A reminder of how life and good cinema can be. Today's show was edited by Nina Norick and researched by Yolene Goffin. Catch up on past episodes over at our website and remember, subscribe to the podcast as well. The Cinema Show is, of course, back next week. I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening.